The next case up is United States versus Wilson. It is docket 20-1324. Counsel, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Meredith Esser. I'm arguing this case on behalf of Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson's case should be remanded because the district court erroneously relied on the policy statement, sentencing guideline 1B113. And we know this because it explicitly said so in its order denying Mr. Wilson's compassionate release motion. After this court's precedence in McGee and Mau Mau, this case should be remanded because it's clear that the district court used the wrong analysis when it was considering Mr. Wilson's motion. Specifically, the order states that the district court made its decision after considering the 3553A factors and the applicable policy statements issued by the Sentencing Commission, which, as we know, no longer apply to defendant filed motions for compassionate release.
Let me, first of all, we're under plain error here, aren't we?
Yes, we argued plain error in the reply brief.
Okay. Looking at your argument that the court impermissibly relied on 1B1.13, I'm struggling with prong three, because the court also says that under the 3553A factors, I would have done the same thing.
I don't want to parse the language of the order, but I don't necessarily think that's exactly what the order says. I think that, and I just want to back up for a second, because I think that the crux of this case actually is about the dangerousness finding that the district court made. So as the government argued below, the government argued for a separate finding of dangerousness, which the court did make under the previous version of the, or under the applicable policy statements, which are no longer applicable. And it quoted the government's analysis of that dangerousness prong. And I think in terms of the 3553A analysis, if the court had realized that it was not required to make that specific dangerousness prong, which triggered the denial or could have independently triggered the denial, it may have weighted the 3553A factors differently. So in other words, the finding of dangerousness could have been an independent basis for denial of the motion, but it also could have affected the 3553A analysis. And there's just no way to know whether or not that occurred here based on what the district court wrote in its order. In addition to that, I think I quoted...
Counsel, can I interrupt you there? Sorry. Don't we know, though, from the district court's order that it specifically weighed the 3553A factors? It appears separately because it said the 3553 factors weigh against early release, and then it specifically mentions that a drastic reduction in his sentence wouldn't reflect the seriousness of the instant offense or promote respect for the law. It doesn't go back to its prior factor that it considered the dangerousness issue and the finding it made, and does the same thing about that. It says it considered the 3553 factors, and it mentions why they weigh against. Why would we assume somehow that second factor consideration carried over into the third factor analysis?
Because I think it was such a strong part of the briefing, and I think there was conflicting record evidence on the dangerousness as the defendant pointed out.
I agree there was conflicting evidence, but the court made that finding separately. And we have said now in McGee and Mau Mau that the 3553A factor, that third factor all by itself, that third bit of analysis can all by itself support the denial of the motion. So I'm struggling to see why we wouldn't assume that that's what happened.
Just
here,
to go back to the language of the order, although the government was arguing that the dangerousness factor could have itself been dispositive, the actual order says that the history and circumstances of the incident offense suggest that he's a danger to the community. So the court didn't actually make a specific finding on that issue, although I think it was looking at the policy statement, and it, in another part of the order, it said that it was looking at the policy statement.
Is there anything wrong with looking at it? All that the court says in this very short order, the introduction, is after considering the applicable factors and the 3553A and the applicable policy statements, is it your position that our case law in the year since that order was issued bars a court from even looking at 1B1.13, or instead that it bars the court from being ruling that it is bound by that? In other words, the considerations in 1B1.13 could be very well valid considerations so long as the district court doesn't feel itself bound by that policy statement. Is that wrong?
No, I think that's right. I think a district court could look to the policy statement for guidance as long as it didn't believe that it was bound by the policy statements.
Isn't that what the order does?
No, I think that the fact that the district court said that these were applicable policy statements, I think that word applicable is quite convincing that the district court did believe the policy statements were applicable to this particular motion.
I thought you just conceded that it's applicable in the sense that the district court can at least look at it for advice or guidance.
I mean, I think that the word applicable has a little bit more force of law than, that it would have guided the analysis. And I don't think there's, I mean, I think on this record, just looking at how the order was laid out, and the fact that the dangerousness finding was quoting the government's briefing about dangerousness, the specific policy statement excerpt that's about dangerousness, I think it's pretty clear that the court thought that the policy statement was binding on it.
I don't get that out of reading this order. It looks to me like it made an independent finding under the 3553A factors, and I don't see anything wrong with considering dangerousness as part of the 3553 analysis, because one of the factors is protecting the public. And so in order to weigh that factor, you need to know how much of a danger this person is to the public, don't you?
Yes, but as I mentioned before, it doesn't, I mean, the district court doesn't say, oh, I'm making a finding of dangerousness as part of my 3553A analysis, because if, you know, and I think our argument is that there was conflicting evidence about dangerousness. Mr. Wilson was on pretrial release for the entire time before he was incarcerated for this offense. And, you know, I think under the old policy statement, the district court was required to make a dangerousness finding. Under the guidance today, it could be part of the 3553A analysis. In addition to that, the district
court... and at our case law, again, we are under plain error, and our case law says now that you don't have to make the dangerousness assessment in order to deny the compassionate release under the 3553. I'm not aware of anything that says that, but, and you can't make it. I mean, there's nothing, even though you don't have to, there's nothing that tells the court that you can't go through, tick off all the things anyway. Is there?
I don't think that that's what the argument is. I think the argument is that the way the order is structured, it's very clear that the court was relying on the policy statement, and so it was using an incorrect legal framework when conceptualizing the motion. I don't think there's anything...
If you were right and the court felt bound by its dangerousness assessment, why didn't it stop and just say, he's a danger to the community and therefore we're done? Why walk through the whole analysis?
I mean, district courts make alternate holdings frequently.
And if it's an alternate holding and one of them is correct, you lose, right?
I mean, I just don't think that we can, I think the order is just so unclear as to what the district court was doing that it's impossible to conclude whether or not these were alternate holdings.
And I think the same problem in the prior case, which is where we have, it's unclear, the reason an objection at the trial level helps is that you can clarify it. But when you're coming to us on plain error and we can read the record as the court did not err, I have trouble saying plainly the court did err.
I mean, I do want to just point out that the defendant's briefing below noted that there was authority suggesting that there were more expansive, extraordinary, and compelling circumstances, and suggesting that there was courts that were interpreting the policy statement as inapplicable at the time. And so even though we were on plain error, I think, or we are on plain error, the legal landscape was really in flux at that time. And I mean, I'm not arguing that it's far easier to decide a case when there's an objection below, but I still think that under the third prong, there is a reasonable probability that if the district court had considered dangerousness as part of the 3553A and had weighed the dangerousness issue appropriately, and in addition to that, had considered the extraordinary and compelling circumstances as part of the 3553A analysis, which it did not do, it may have come to a different conclusion as to Mr. Wilson's motion, the merits of his motion.
Well, let me ask you, because that confuses me. If we were to remand, what would happen in district court? The district court has said that there's a reason to be concerned about danger to the public. That's going to be the case regardless, isn't it? And it's just as insertable into 3553A as it is into 1B1.13. So what is the purpose of the remand? The court's already made the factual findings it would need to make.
I mean, I think it's difficult to say what the district court would do today because the circumstances are quite different. For example, Mr. Wilson has served quite a bit more of his sentence, about 60 or 70% today. And I think that, there could be different analysis on the dangerousness finding if Mr. Wilson had demonstrated that in BOP custody, he had been a model inmate. There's really no way to know what the circumstances in front of the district court would be today. I think just on this order, the fact that there's so much unknown here gives us a reasonable likelihood that the district court would have come to a different conclusion. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, Paul Farley for the government. This court's recent Hall decision, which we provide as a 28J, makes it clear that the district courts may deny compassionate release motions when any of the three prerequisites is lacking and do not need to address the others. So I can discuss the first and second requirements, but I'd like to start with the third one, the 3553A factors, because I think it's the shortest and surest route to resolving this appeal. The district court denied relief after a complete review of the motion on the merits and considering the 3553A factors, noted the defendant had served less than a third of his sentence, the criminal history and the nature of the instant offense, noting that despite two prior felony convictions, he was driving around the middle of the night with a dealer-level stash of drugs and two loaded guns, and that such a drastic reduction as he was seeking would neither reflect the seriousness of the instant offense nor promote respect for the law. And this, after the court had already varied downward by almost a year from the applicable guideline range when it imposed the sentence. The court was not required to do really anything beyond that. I think, as was pointed out, if there's some ambiguity in the record here, we're on plain error, and sort of the tie goes to the district court. And Hall further said the judge didn't need to provide a lengthy explanation if the context in the record made clear she had a reasoned basis for her decision. And so we look at the whole record as the judge did. The judge said she undertook a complete review, which included the PSR's detailing of his criminal conduct over more than a quarter century with steadily escalating severity. And as the government explained, over 20 years, he had never demonstrated respect for the law or willingness to take the lessons of a criminal conviction or punishment to heart to change his lifestyle. And so it seems very clear that the court made an independent 3553A finding based upon the entirety of the record. I point out that the motion here was denied by the same judge who had accepted the guilty plea, reviewed the objections to and approved the PSR, and imposed the original sentence. So she thoroughly understood this.
In the district court, did the government take the position that 1B1.13 was binding on the district court judge?
Yes, Your Honor. Both parties took that position.
That matter? Should that matter as part of our consideration?
I think it certainly matters this far. We know what the parties urged. I think it's clear that we don't know how the court accepted that. As this court recently said in Carr in the last couple of months, and I think as you pointed out in your questioning my opponent, Your Honor, the district court has the discretion to consider those application notes regardless of whether they're binding or not. In fact, Hall kind of re-underscored that, said it would hardly be an abuse of discretion for district court to look to the present policy statement for guidance. I think at most, though, what we could say is there was an assumption by certainly the parties that they applied because had not heard on McGee, for example. But let's assume for sake of argument that the district court did feel bound. This goes back to the Carrillero Escobar case we filed as a 28J, where the court said the parties in the district court seem to have at least assumed that 1B113 applied. I think that's probably where we find ourselves. But again, we're on plain error. And even if there was error, which was plain, the defendant can't meet the third prong of plain error because the error didn't affect the outcome of the motion. Why? Because the court had already expressly made an independent finding of the 3553A factors, didn't support the request. And that finding warranted denying the motion independent of any policy statement.
How do we know, counsel, as Ms. Esser suggests, that the dangerousness conclusion under the second factor didn't bleed over into the 3553A analysis?
Your Honor, what we don't know one way or the other, and I think it's of no moment because
it's of a moment if you do what you just suggested, which is assume that it was plain error to consider the policy statement as binding, or we would assume that the court considered it as binding. Then if we're assuming that, then certainly we could also perhaps assume that it bled into the 3553A analysis. Or could we?
Your Honor, I would pick up on a point Judge Phillips made a few moments ago, which is the court has made its findings. It would consider his lengthy criminal history and the danger to the public, because protecting the public is a valid 3553A factor. And so I don't know how one could say, go back, make the same factual findings, but put dangerousness, the concept of dangerousness over here in your head, but go ahead and apply it in terms of protecting the public. I think that particularly in this area, there's a lot of overlap, right? There are medical concerns, which could be considered as part of the 3553A factors. Those are also in the policy statement. I don't think there's any meaningful way to really segregate out factually those kinds of considerations.
Could you also address, I don't think we discussed it in the opening argument here, but could you also address the argument that the appellant makes about the Hald case, where we had some language in there indicating that we said we're not saying that a court can deny a compassionate relief on the ground that release is not appropriate under 3553A if the court has not considered the facts allegedly establishing extraordinary and compelling reasons for the release. We made a distinction in that case between actually not having to determine the extraordinary and compelling reasons, but perhaps needing to consider them when deciding a 3553A or conducting a 3553A analysis. Do we have any evidence that the court here considered the alleged extraordinary and compelling circumstances when conducting the 3553A analysis?
There's nothing in the court's order that says that. But again, it is our position the court need not specifically say that. Certainly, to date, this court's precedents haven't required courts to touch each and every little space or item in the analysis, nor do they have to write a lengthy opinion. I note in the Hall case that there were three defendants there. As to defendant Hall, the court said that COVID-19 might qualify. So didn't quite find that, but clearly had considered it. And in Sands, the government conceded it. And so right,
In Hald, I think the court did specifically note that it wouldn't really have the issue because both the two judges in those two cases had specifically mentioned the alleged extraordinary circumstances when deciding the or conducting the 3553A analysis. And we don't have that here. And so I do see a distinction. And I guess I'm asking you, what do we make of that statement in Hald?
I think the court has to satisfy itself they were considered. I would say in Hald and Sands, those two defendants, there was only a clause. It wasn't even an entire sentence in the order
I'm not asking you about those two cases. I think the court did satisfy itself in those two cases that it had been considered. If we have to satisfy ourselves here that they have been considered, how do we do that from this order?
The only way, Your Honor, from this order that you can satisfy yourself is the court's opening statement that it undertook a complete review of the record and the extraordinary and compelling circumstances were both addressed pretty extensively, both by the defendant and by the government. If the court wants to say that in this circuit, you actually have to say something in your order, like the examples in Hall, then a remand would be in order because the court did not say, and I specifically considered the COVID-19 issue, which the defendant raised. But I think a complete review of the order under these circumstances suffices. If there are no further questions, I'm happy to relinquish the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to briefly address this issue in Hall's because I think that was actually the focus of much of this briefing was what was the effect of the fact that the district court had made no specific findings about the extraordinary and compelling circumstances. I think the fact that those were not mentioned anywhere in this order is another significant reason why under third prong, there's a reasonable probability that the district court's weighting of the factors may be different because, you know, as this court noted in Hall, essentially if the 3553A factors are affected by the extraordinary and compelling circumstances presented by a defendant, especially as here where the government actually conceded that there were extraordinary and compelling circumstances, that should have weighed heavily in the 3553A analysis. But the
counsel, court counsel, can I interrupt you on that? I didn't understand your argument to be that somehow hauled in this dicta essentially was indicating that there's a requirement that the court explicitly state in its 3553A analysis that it's considering the extraordinary and compelling circumstances factors. Is that what you're arguing? And I don't think that's what Hald said.
I don't know whether it needs to be explicit or not. I think in this case, I don't think that we can say that it was considered at all, because the district court was using a legal standard in which the extraordinary and compelling circumstances are separate finding, and it didn't have any direction that the extraordinary and compelling circumstances would have factored into the 3553A analysis. And the fact that it made no finding at all on the extraordinary and compelling aspect of the case strongly suggests that it did not factor into the 3553A analysis. I see that I'm out of time, and I would ask that this court remand for reconsideration of Mr. Wilson's motion. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. The case is submitted.